Hey, welcome. I'm today's host of the Valley Pod, Owen Woods, where we talk to all the interesting people of the St. Louis Valley. On today's episode, we catch up with rebuilding director Max Walker Silverman. He's the writer and director of the film that was shot over the summer of 2023 here in the St. Louis Valley, starring Josh O'Connor and Amy Madigan. We talked earlier last week after he showed a private screening of the film at the Sky High Six Theater to friends and family of people who took part in the production of the movie. Here's our conversation with Max Walker Silverman. Thanks. All right. I'll do my intro stuff in post-production. I'll just kind of get right into it. I will I'll have you introduce yourself, Max. Welcome this morning.
Hello. My name is Max Walker Silverman, and I guess I'm here as the writer and director of the film Rebuilding, which was shot in the Valley in the summer of 2023 and is now finally beginning to come out into the world.
Yeah. I should mention we had a private screening last night with a lot of locals and people that you had participate in the movie. It was minus a few seats. It was a pretty packed theater. It was really cool to see. Really enjoyed having that experience. It's cool to sit in a theater with a packed bunch of people and everybody's eating popcorn and drinking, but to watch a movie that all of us kind of made, that the Valley made, was really special. So I want to say thanks for doing that last night.
Gosh, I mean, least we could do. The truth is this movie owes the debt of gratitude to the people and places in the Valley so deeply. It truly was just made by so many people here. So yes, very important, of course, to bring it back and let people see some roads and mountains they recognize.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's a unique experience, especially for somebody like myself who grew up here. You know, there's been a few movies shot here, but to have a movie that takes place here, the characters are from here, the story is about this place and the place, how it interacts with people and how people interact with it. I'd say for probably a lot of us, this is the first time. It's the first time seeing this place be the center of attention or the focal point of a story on the big screen, which is a pretty cool experience for the local guys like myself. So I want to get into a little bit of your background kind of before we get into the movie. Tell me about yourself, where you grew up, and how you got into film.
I grew up in Telluride, Colorado, so only about 70 miles as the crow flies to the other side of San Juan's, but of course, kind of a different world in many ways. And, you know, it's been a tourist sort of town for a long time. But when I was a kid, there was still like a really funky sort of artsy scene there. And I think in hindsight was raised by whatever they were rednecks or they were hippies or whatever they were. But everyone worked, but everyone made art too. And grew up doing sports, but also doing theater, and just had a lot of good teachers, and was raised by the village in a nice way. And even though the town was kind of changing and gentrifying, and that was like a constant losing struggle, which continues, there was a sense of community and a sense of funk that made it a pretty cool place to grow up.
Yeah.
Went to college in California. Dug it, cool place, and then sort of stumbled into graduate film school in New York. Not because cinema was like a dream necessarily, but just because liked art and writing and making things, and that seemed sort of like the medium of its time and like a good thing to learn how to do. And while there, began coming back home to Colorado doing short films and bringing some friends from school. And sort of they wound up mixing with my friends from home, sort of both in front of and behind the camera. We did a short in Norwood and then a short in Telluride. And then that in COVID, we did a feature film in Norwood, Colorado. The same sort of approach of just a really small crew of friends. And then this movie Rebuilding, which we filmed here in the Valley, which is... Yeah, hadn't been to since like high school for soccer games and camping at the sand dunes and stuff, but wound up just driving through kind of by accident coming back home from New Mexico one day and was like, man, it was one of those days when there was, you know, snow on the sand dunes and just like, this place is unreal. And yeah, so familiar, but so different too. And,
yeah.
And I think I think it was like really moving to me, like hanging out in the valley again, because there's kind of this like sense of history and community here that's really in many ways been lost in like the ski towns, especially.
Big time. Yeah.
And you know, of course there's pros and cons to all the money, but yeah, it made me like, I don't know, it kind of reminded me of like a different version or an older version or even a more naive version of my town. So,
it's cool.
It's like, yeah, this would be a good place to make a film.
It is. It's a hell of a place to make a film, and it's untapped too. I think the film potential here is pretty crazy. There's some places I would go mountain biking up by Del Norte, and I'm like, you could make a Western here for nothing, you know, like no power lines, no buildings out in the distance, nothing. It's just 1650, 1850, 1950 doesn't make a difference. There's a lot of like really untapped places here. Do you have any desire to continue to lens this place at all?
I mean, I would love to. It's just, the whole film thing has kind of like come about in reverse as like, it's like largely, it's such a social art form, I guess, you know? And first with the short films and stuff, like I realized I could, like I would bring my good friends from film school and then I would cast all my best friends from childhood. I was like, wow, I'm able to put all my favorite people together in one place and they have to be here. I'm like, wow, what a great selfish thing for me. And then now I've been able to sort of pay people to do that as well, which is even better. And then so to be able to like kind of be in a place one likes to be while assembling all your favorite people is better still. And I would love to keep working in the valley if possible.
Yeah. I want to talk about kind of your experience shooting your previous film, A Love Song, which you filmed in northern New Mexico, right?
In Norwood, Colorado.
Oh, Norwood, I'm sorry. I just kind of want to get your view of how you went from that movie to this one and kind of the approach, the differences, and how the two experiences lend themselves to one another.
A Love Song really felt like making a short film that was longer, or at least that was sort of the naive ignorance that we brought going into it, not knowing any better. So we shot it with about 10 people.
Wow.
And most of the film is one or two actors, and we were all in one location. And it was COVID, so we were in a bubble. So it was really contained and kind of a magic accident in that sense. It was, you know, like producer Jesse Hope, cinematographer Alfonso Herrera Salcedo, production designer Juliana Barreto, like all my classmates. And it was just like so lovely, you know, and maybe kind of learned in that film doesn't have to be this like hacking through the jungle sort of like biblical struggle.
Right. Yeah. We don't all have to go into the heart of darkness. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. Which is like such a kind of romanticized concept of it, but it's not really how it has to be.
Right.
And then come approaching rebuilding, it was definitely a bigger movie and a bigger challenge practically. Just like a lot more cast, a lot more locations, a lot bigger logistics, a lot more work for an art department, for a costume department, a lot more for me to keep track of. But it's largely the same main crew. They were just able to hire a bit more help, which was really nice. So the crew expanded, the resources expanded a bit. People call it a small film. To me, it was like a huge film, you know. We had catering and like all sorts of, you know, it wasn't my mom bringing lunch. So that was felt like a huge jump. Yeah, still largely natural, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew that there was a different level of filmmaking when you guys were filming on First Street at the Blue House, and I saw your gaffing setups and all of your stuff. I was like, oh, this is the real deal, you know. I thought it was really cool to see, because I went to film school, and so I spent a lot of time on film sets, and it was nice to kind of see the level of equipment that so many movies have, and not a lot of people realize it goes into the kinds of stuff that you have to do to set up a shot and all the prep work and the amount of material that's required to get certain shots. It was really cool for the, I think, for the community to kind of see that this is a real process. This is a real collaborative art form that requires so many different people knowing how to do things, and getting to see your little bit behind the scenes as I was walking by. I was like, oh, this is cool. This is really cool. This is an evolution for the St. Louis Valley.
Yeah, it's a funny craft, you know, because sometimes like it takes 100 people to get just like, it's kind of like the irony is ultimately you're chasing something that looks and feels real.
Right.
But it's such a weird form that it takes a lot of kind of dedicate, like insanely dedicated artifice to come back around to something real. And I don't know, I find that very moving, you know, that a film set could have 50 people and each one of them has very, very specific, like needle sharp job that they do with like so much care and dedication, and all of those things like come back together into some simple viewing experience.
Yeah.
You hope.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's also in many ways like ludicrously inefficient. Right, but that's, it's kind of fun, you know. I don't know. I like that like team sport aspect of it.
Yeah.
Kind of being on this adventure with so many odd people who wouldn't be together and on the same street in Alamosa for any other reason.
Yeah, and to then say, okay, that's a wrap for the day, like, and then hoping all those people have the trust in you to deliver their hard work on the screen. That's a lot of pressure for a director, for a filmmaker, you know, but also they do trust you. They're taking the leap of faith with you.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the funny thing is you have, no one has a single clue if the thing's going to be any good.
Yeah.
Myself included, like you go out there and the actors do their best and the people light it and people put on the costumes and the camera goes where it goes and the lens films what it films and the sound records what it records. But it's so abstracted from any, like, you're not in the narrative, you know, you're shooting this thing over many weeks and it's all out of order. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one little scene might take 2 days. Like, you actually have really no idea how things are going to fit together. It really is all a leap of faith. So there's like a whole big like shrug and a hold your breath and a prayer to it at the end of the day. And then like a year later, once it's all edited, you begin to have a sense of what it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always kind of thought that the editing is where you find the movie, but it's also where you find the magic of filmmaking. I feel like there's a lot of the magic in the editing process of putting all those pieces together and finally realizing it. But then the stitching and the structuring is kind of its own magical realism too in the filmmaking process. What was editing like on this movie for you?
It was, well, let's see. I mean, we finished shooting in the Valley and then went back home to Telluride. And for a couple months, it was just me and my friend Ramsey working in my mom's house.
Nice.
And, I think the early stages of editing are like largely one of despair.
Yeah.
And you see like rough cuts and you just want to sink into the earth because you're like, this is an absolute disaster. And all you can think about is like how to somehow find a way that to like never show the movie to anyone. But then, you know, you just have to trust the process of it, which is ultimately very relieving thing of just pass by pass, cut by cut, and eventually moved to New York for a few months, worked with an editor named Jane Rizzo, and just slowly a thing begins to rediscover itself, or actually in many ways discover itself for the first time.
Oh, right.
Because that is kind of the most like literary part of the process in a sense of like, that's the only time you're actually putting together the film. Like everything else is sort of build it, like finding, like you're kind of like finding Lego blocks and like putting them into a big plastic bin, and then the editing is where you're actually sort of sorting them together and like building the spaceship or whatever.
Yeah.
and then you, wind up with a film, for better or worse.
Yeah. How long were you shooting in the San Luis Valley? What was your schedule like?
Well, we were here in pre-production, so sort of scouting and figuring out everything for a few months, I don't know, 3 months or so. And then the actual filming was about 6.5 weeks.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So, you know, long enough to go from the end of winter to the fall.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you get Josh O'Connor for 6 weeks? He's a busy guy, man.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think he had been taking a little break.
Oh, nice.
And sent him the script, and got a Instagram DM from him.
Wow.
Like 12 hours later saying, wow, this looks great. Let's do it.
And that's awesome. We
chatted and he really, I think, resonated with the sort of like ecological themes of the film, even though he's from a really different place, and brought him out here and put him to work on a farm for a while.
Nice.
And got him sunburnt and it was so special also to just see, like, he's someone who's like irrepressibly capable of wonder.
Wow.
Like every day he was amazed by things, you know, like amazed by Blanca, amazed by the cowboys, like and that's such a nice energy to have at the center of a film set.
Well, and he's such a
amazed by IHOP.
I mean, it's this for an Englishman, this is probably quite the American place to be for a while. You know, this is a different part of America.
Yeah, I think he was like surprised and delighted by like how real you know, rodeos are.
Yeah, right.
How real ranching is, like all these things that one might have imagined are kind of romantic and somewhat fictionalized, or like yes, there are people in cowboy hats all over the place.
Pearl snaps and cowboy hats, that's just part of the attire for a lot of people, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was really nice to watch him. I thought he fit in very well. His dialogue was great. He was just a very quiet kind of guy, and I thought that he fit really well into kind of the valley archetype of that kind of character. I thought that he could have been at any Monta Vista livestock auction and I wouldn't have second guessed it, you know? So I thought he was a really good choice. How long did he work with a dialect coach, or how long did he work on his American accent? Because it's different from the other things he's done. Do you have any insight on that?
I guess, it was a while. I can't remember exactly, but it was quite a while, and you know, he worked with a dialect coach, and I remember going and there's a great old cowboy from the Telluride area named Marvin Schmidt from like a legendary ranch family there, who it was a great excuse to go hang out with him and
nice.
Just like record him telling a bunch of stories, which was really cool.
Wow.
'Cause as you know, I mean, if there's two cowboys, like one of them won't say a word and the other won't stop talking,
yep,
you know?
Yep.
So I guess the Josh O'Connor character is more the quiet type, but Marvin will tell some stories and recorded those and would send them to Josh and he'd work on it. And I mean, I don't know. It was funny, but I think, you know, acting is such a weird skill.
Right.
But and like such a specific craft, but I do kind of think there's something beautiful that people from very different worlds can like bring something to a character that they're playing. Yeah, it was really nice to work with Josh.
Yeah. You also worked with Amy Madigan, which, you know, she gave us a wild performance in Weapons, and this is the polar opposite. I really appreciated seeing her twice this year. What was working with her like?
It was cool. I mean, she's just like she's a cinema icon to me, you know, and it's such a, that's one of the really crazy things about this job is meeting people who you like.
Yeah.
Feel like you know, or like even a child version of you from watching like Uncle Buck feels like you know, and then here they are at like the Hampton Inn or whatever in Colorado. And it was cool. I mean, she's just so cool and has lived such an interesting life and it's always kind of cool to like be able to tap into like a sort of whatever, like a cinematic legacy that someone carries just within their presence, and sort of plug that into your own little story. But she's sweet, you know, she was so nice with Lily, who plays little girl, and one of those old school, like arrive on set and learn everybody's names within five minutes and bing, bang, boom. So yeah, I dig it.
Yeah. She had people laughing 1 minute and then crying the next minute. It was really cool to see that in that very short period of time, how she just gave two incredible versions of this character, and the audience laughed when she showed her plants to Callie Rose and then the different part. But it was really cool to see, even though she wasn't in it for all that much screen time, it was really nice to have such a powerhouse in this movie, because she really is, like, she's a cinema icon in my opinion.
It's such a luxury, in especially with supporting roles, to be able to bring in like real sort of firepower like that, and the hope, the idea is that it makes the smaller parts feel real and memorable and important, which of course they are.
I thought that she lived in that house, you know what I mean? It was, that house very much reflected who she was as a character. And even though, again, we don't see her for all that much time, you had her live in that world, and I thought it was really compelling. It really was.
Well, yeah, I'm, well, speaking of the house, I mean, and that's important, you know, like that's like a old Alamosa house, but also was a huge art department project, and Liana and her art team like totally, I think, like repainted and redid it.
Wow.
And found all sorts of antique local furniture and really made it an extension of that character.
Yeah.
Which matters, you know.
It does. No, it's those little things that our subconscious picks up on that, you know, we're not being cognizant of, but it's all part of the picture that's making, you know, the whole frame complete. And I really appreciated the care and design of that house. It felt like a lived in place. It felt like this is where people have lived for a long time and they know where everything is. How was it working with the real family of that house? You know, how did you approach them to say, hey, can we use your house?
I remember them being very nice. I mean, it's always kind of shocking when someone is, when you explain like, hi, would you mind, we'll get you some hotel rooms for a little while and we're going to completely repaint and rearrange your house. And then we're going to completely put it back the way it was. And, you know, we'll pay you, but how does that sound? And it's always shocking when people say, sure.
Yeah.
So I think it was kind of weird and fun for them. I hope so. You know, we try to treat people well, take a lot of pride in that. So very, very grateful to them. We took good care of the chickens and.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Thank you guys for letting us use your beautiful house.
So it's a beautiful home. And I thought you captured it on camera really well. It's just kind of,
I think it's one of the oldest in town, if I recall correctly.
That sounds right. That sounds right. Speaking of kind of working with people who are unfamiliar with this world, you worked with a lot of non-actors, a lot of locals. How do you find that process to be? Because I always think of this quote by Taika Waititi when he worked on his movie Boy. He said, you can only work with non-actors and non-acting children once, because then you ruin them. how was your experience working with some non-actors here in the Valley?
I mean, good. Like, I don't know. Yeah. It just starts from it all again, like, kind of comes back to this like social approach of like, it's just fun. Like it is nice to work with people, and I don't know. It's weird too. Like it just in the sense of it's weird, you know, to bring in a professional actor and like, you know, put them in some blue jeans and a cowboy hat. Like it's also weird to bring in a rancher and put a camera in his face and a microphone above his head and tell him where to stand, you know. Like the hope is that somehow those different versions of weird like mix together into something that starts to approximate reality. I don't know, but what I can say for sure is that it's like fun, you know. And it's fun for me to get to work with people who might be able to like check me if I'm having a character do something that they wouldn't actually do, or having a you know, rancher do something that they wouldn't actually do. And I think it's fun for people to get to just do something so weird as be in a movie. It pays good and it's nice. Like, I don't know. I just can't help it. I like working with all kinds of different people.
How do you approach like the conversation? Like, do you kind of say, hey, this is like, how do you, I guess a better way to ask this, how do you direct them versus an actor, you know, somebody who's been directed before? Do you have a different approach? Do you have a different style? I'm just kind of curious how you direct somebody who's never been directed before in such a way.
Well, I think the first thing, and like a really important thing, is to be clear with people that like, I'm not asking you to play yourself. Mm-hmm. That's often what directors, filmmakers do with people who haven't acted before, is kind of act as though they're playing themselves. Like, that to me, that doesn't work, you know? Like,
yeah,
it's fiction, and fiction is really freeing, and it's really hard to play yourself. So even though all of these people are something kind of like themselves, probably, it's, they're a character, you know, and they have names and they have lines, and sort of figure out where they should stand and what they should do. And I think I try to sort of get rid of as many of the decisions that they might have to make while filming. Mm-hmm. And the hope is that that's not restricting, that it's actually liberating, you know, that by not having to figure out like, oh, where do I stand? Where do I move? Where do I look? What do I do with my hands? Like all those awkward things that anyone who's ever had their picture taken knows how self-conscious and weird it is to be in a camera. Like if you can decide a lot of those things together and ahead of time, often you can find the space for like to actually be in the moment, you know? And then it's just the kind of the magic of multiple takes.
Yeah.
Take one, you're figuring something out. Take two, you're figuring something else out. Take three, you're figuring something else out. That's a weird process, but all you need is that little magic once, you know, and we can always get there.
Yeah, no, I think I think you got some really compelling stuff out of some people that are just valley faces. It was really cool to see.
Because some people are just natural, you know, like Dwight Mondragon was one of the first people in the valley I met, just because we were looking at ranches for locations, and his place in San Luis wound up being too far away to shoot at. But man, you should just play this character. I think that was a character we've been planning to bring in a professional actor for.
He was fantastic. He really was.
Yeah, but he just was so natural. Some people really have an easy time with it. Yeah. I don't know.
Lily Latour, who plays Callie Rose, she was incredible, man. Where did you find her?
Well, ironically, found her in Australia.
Wow.
I did a huge search for this part. She's like an 8-year-old girl, this character, and you know, got sent thousands of audition tapes, and this one specific tape really was so striking. And then it's like, all right, let's meet this girl. Mm-hmm. Where do I go? And I was like, oh, you got to go to a small town in Australia.
Wow.
Which was pretty amazing. She'd never been to the United States before, but grew up in a rural place with chickens and dogs, and the drive to go visit her grandparents was like totally blackened by wildfires.
Wow.
And it was cool, and kind of realized, like Josh too, who's from the rural United Kingdom, like it there was kind of an experiment in the casting of the professionals of almost prioritizing like a shared sort of non-urban experience over nationality. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know, it's interesting to me. But anyway, just Lily is such a great professional actor, man, and like we all I think had to up our games to work with her, because she was really on it and really prepared.
And a compelling American accent. I never would have guessed she was Australian. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know how she does it.
Especially for that age. I mean, it's crazy to be able to nail that accent out of the park. Was really cool.
Yeah. Working with her was like, oh, wow. Like, there are some people who are, like, truly talented, like, actually talented at this thing. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot about acting that is that is practice and that is learning and that is like learning the tricks and the crafts. And then, you meet someone with Lily and you're like, oh yeah, just like anything, they're kind of our savants also.
Right. Yeah. These little people that just are like born with it. I don't know how else to describe it. Yeah. I really thought you had some really great performances in this movie and really real characters. But one of the characters that stood out to me, and I was looking him up last night, was the guy that played Derek, Binky Griptight. Who is he? Like, where did he come from? I thought he was fantastic.
Binky is, this kind of just illustrates how sort of broadly casted the film was. But he's a musician, hadn't acted before, and kind of a legendary musician, actually. He just did guitar on like Amy Winehouse's. He was like the lead guitar for Amy Winehouse. And another, like, I think we were casting that part locally and got this great tape, and it turned out to be from this dude's kitchen in Brooklyn.
It's awesome.
But just, that part played music as well. Read really well. He had this beautiful silver dobro. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, well, I guess this guy's coming from Brooklyn.
It's awesome.
But Binky, total legend, man.
Yeah, I thought his performance was great. He has such a cool look, and his hair was really cool. I resonated with him. I don't know what it was, but it was really cool to see him. But to learn that he's this musical legend was really, really pretty cool. Because I thought he was a local. I was like, I've never seen this guy before.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like a Colorado guy. Mm-hmm. That's, again, sometimes it's weird. You gotta stretch reality to sort of reassemble it.
So I kind of want to kind of change course here a little bit to talk about maybe some conversations you had with your director of photography, Alfonso Rivera Salcedo. Really beautiful cinematography in this movie. I thought your lighting was great, your shots. But what the challenge I've always had as a filmmaker in the San Luis Valley is like capturing people and Mount Blanc at the same time. And I know sometimes it comes down to lens, but how did you and your director of photography kind of land on your camera and lighting setups? And what kind of conversations did you have to capture the San Luis Valley as you did? Kind of that process of cinematography, of lighting, just the kinds of things you said, okay, this is how we have to shoot this place.
Well, let's see. I mean, we filmed digitally, which was new for us. Mm-hmm. We'd always been on film before, on celluloid, and I think it was partially like a curiosity of just like try something new, but also to keep the film feeling contemporary, because there's a lot of slightly anachronistic characters and people who are out of time in the movie, but it's a modern story, it's contemporary.
Oh,
and
yeah,
wanted to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. Make it feel like it's now, which it is. And the lensing also, I think they're like really quite modern Leicas, really pretty sharp. Mm-hmm. And we were able to test a lot of different setups.
Nice.
So thanks to the production for supporting that. And that was the combination we landed on of a very contemporary setup that later in color correction,
right,
we undid some of the sharpness. It's like we know we're in such a beautiful place,
right?
You know, like there's these crazy ass mountains, there's this crazy ass prairie, you get crazy sunsets, you get crazy sunrises, you get crazy thunderstorms, you get crazy clouds. Like it is like just so, it is just beautiful naturally. So almost one of the challenges is like we're always telling ourselves of, you know, if someone is watching a scene and thinking, wow, what a beautiful shot. Mm-hmm. Or like, oh, what great camera work. Like to us, there's a small failure in that actually. Mm-hmm. Of that means that they're not fully paying attention to the story. So especially in such a beautiful place, like weirdly, one of the challenges is keeping the camera, quiet almost.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Because it can easily over, especially with such a quiet story, it can easily overwhelm the characters and the plot. So there's like every sort of camera trick in there, you know. There's static, there's dollies, there's handheld, there's sliders, there's car work, there's but I think all of it is designed to be very subtle and not to call attention to itself.
It was very invisible cinematography, and that's, you know, that's kind of one of the things that I always try to tell people is a cinematographer, good cinematography is invisible, good editing is invisible, because it is supposed to match your story.
Right, the whole thing, that's the whole idea of like, you know, the work is the craft, and then the art is hiding the craft or exactly. whatever, which is quite true of, and other than that, we sort of block the scenes first with the actors, and then it's a question of with the camera of just how do we tell the story of this scene. A lot of the decisions are where to put the camera, and then a lot of discussion about what lens, and then had a great gaffer named Andrew Hubbard, and who's like the lighting technician, and he and his team would figure out what the setup needs, and sometimes that was quite extensive, and sometimes it's nothing at all. Also, right. when you're outside, and sometimes it actually takes like really experienced, confident technicians to say this doesn't need anything.
Wow,
which is true of all, it's true of costumes, it's true of makeup, it's true of cinematography, it's true of all pieces of the film. That's like always something I'm looking for, and people I work with is people who are going to have the confidence to say, I don't need to add anything to this.
Where do you find yourself in relation to the camera when you're actually shooting? Are you standing next to the camera? Do you have a monitor? Are you in Video Village? What's your process when it actually comes time to shooting? Where are you in relation to the camera?
I don't know. It depends. Yeah, I guess usually I have like a little monitor of my own, and just like tuck away somewhere. Somewhere close, but sometimes if it's depending on the setup, we'll just, and this is partially from having shot so much with film where your monitoring is really limited,
right?
Like very used to not seeing what the camera's seeing and just watching it with my own eyes and trusting that the camera and the cameraman are seeing it properly. But there's no Video Village.
Nice.
Definitely it's important to try to provide monitors for your collaborators who need to know what's going on. But no, I always will stay close to the camera and close to the actors and hopefully not be in the shot, I often am.
Nice. Do you ever get behind the camera yourself?
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. And Alfonso is very polite about letting me do that, but he's a great operator at the end of the day. And it's usually better to let him do that.
Nice. I want to get your insight as a filmmaker who's shooting stuff in Colorado, as somebody who's from Colorado. You know, we have the state has a lot of opportunity to support more filmmakers and more filmmaking. You know, I wouldn't say we're competing with New Mexico. New Mexico was ahead of the game, but I think that Colorado is starting to kind of maybe realize that there's some filmmaking potential. In your view, as somebody who's making movies here, what is the future of filmmaking in Colorado? What do you see happening?
I honestly don't know. I mean, there's like a few different levels to this question. Mm-hmm. There's one level that's just like filmmaking in Colorado is great. Like it's beautiful. It's varied. It's, the parking is ample.
yeah.
And it's been a great place to work. And I have been supported by the state film office and their incentive. But it does all come down to incentives. And, you know, New Mexico has become what it was as a production base because of they've spent huge amounts of taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
That's same with Georgia. That's same with, you know, anywhere. And even though it's like a game that everyone kind of has to play at this point, like I can't at the end of the day, like, come here and say Colorado needs to spend more money to bring in film production. Like, I don't know, maybe we do, but also is it kind of weird for me that like potato farmers' tax dollars are going to go to kind of subsidize like a Netflix movie? Like, I don't know. Yeah, it is. That is sort of weird. So
yeah,
I don't know. Like, on the one hand, of course I want more things to be here and more people to work. But on the other, like, I can't help but believe it's somehow kind of like a losing game for all these state governments to sort of compete with who can like help out these huge corporations most.
Yeah. No, you bring up an interesting point.
And I wish, of course, that there was a way for state governments or federal governments to support like artists, you know, and smaller films, like the sorts that really need it. But the way it's set up in the United States is that that isn't how it works. It's all purely, purely commercial.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know. The tax stuff is all pretty fickle.
It is. It seems fickle. And I think that, you know, like a lot of the conversations that are happening right now, at least on, you know, online, or, you know, how it's not making box office, it's not making its return in box office, you know, one battle after another in Bugonia, they're talking about, oh, they're not going to make their return. But it's like, why is the conversation shifted into this box office number rather than like, did the overwhelming majority of people who saw this movie, did they take something away from this? But yet our interests are so capitalized, they're so corporatized that we're not even having that conversation of what did this movie actually mean to you? It's what did this movie mean to the box office? And I think that that's like the wrong approach to have, especially for like a community like the San Luis Valley. Like if Netflix comes down here and gets a giant tax incentive to make a movie and then they leave, it's like, well, what was accomplished? You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that all kind of demonstrates like how unusual it was that for like 100 years or whatever, film happened to be this art form that was like both, that was at once like kind of artistically awesome, broadly societally consumed,
right,
and commercially successful. Like that's actually like such a weird triangulation.
It is.
That what's odd is not that that's not happening anymore. What's odd is that that ever happened.
Right.
And yeah, beyond like state by state incentives and sort of the future of them, like there are way bigger things at play, which is essentially just that like the world is changing and the internet has changed the way people consume things. Yep. And like the phone is the dominant sort of interaction now in our lives.
Right.
So any amount of asking someone to be not really on their phone for 2 hours is going to be hard. And movies are no longer kind of like the go-to unplug or like the go-to relax or whatever, which is weird, and it's going to be weird, and it's going to be hard for movies and the movie industry to adjust to that. And it's going to be painful too, because it's become, it was for a while able to be a kind of amazing thing, which was like a powerfully unionized industry where people, whether you were like top dog on a film set or a PA, like you were kind of getting a like protection and a career, and that's a great thing and should be protected.
Yeah.
But it's going to be hard because it's film is not going to go on as the central, like the center of our cultural wheel, you know, like I think that's over.
Yeah.
And it's going to be sad for a lot of reasons, but I remind myself that that also happened to like books and radio.
It's true.
Which I still love very much and continue to be part of our lives. And I think film will be too.
I think so too. And I think it was very eye-opening, the writer's strike a couple of years ago, it really shut down Hollywood. It shut down movies for a lot of people and it put productions behind. And I think it was really eye-opening for the rest of the world to understand that's like, these are the kinds of, you know, conversations that the Writers Guild is having. It's how do we protect ourselves from corporatization? How do we protect ourselves from being overtaken by AI? And so, you know, those unions that are very strong were losing that that strength that they have, because now you can just, you can have some guy at a corporation say, okay, then no more, you know, we're not going to do this. And that's, that I think is really painful, of seeing how important the Writers Guild is, but then seeing all this undermining of that and all this precious entertainment that we have can be shut down from both sides for a morally good reason and a morally scrupulous reason. And I'm hoping that more people realize that it's, you know, it's this really social collaborative art form that requires some buy-in from the public and some understanding that if the director and your PA are not treated the same, then there's a dichotomy that shouldn't exist. The unions are designed to make sure that we're all making this movie together. And then there's just this undermining that I think is really scary.
Yeah, it's
you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the other thing is, like, I'm so on the fringes of the business, if you can call it that, that I, like, really just see everything happen from afar. But, yeah, of course, it's, like, so sad to imagine AI taking our work or my work. Like, I love my work, you know. I don't want it to be taken away. Part of life.
Yeah,
but of course it is just so weird that it's both, this is both like a very pure serious art form and extremely capitalistic exploitative industry. Like,
yeah,
it's both, and that's always gonna be a weird clash. And for a while, like, the unions admirably were able to carve out, like, some good honest lives for people, but it's just going to be harder and harder.
Yeah. I think, you know, we forget that a lot of film is a trade. You need truck drivers, you need electricians, you need carpenters, and that's not all work in a film. You need people who know how to do stuff. You need plumbers, and, you know, it's incredible the kind of
gamut. We hired a bunch of carpenters and drivers and cooks. And
They're everybody involved is playing a part. You said that needle point job that somebody might have on a set is just as important as everybody else, and it collapses otherwise. Max, I really appreciate taking the time to talk with me today, being on the Valley Pod, being, you know, coming to Alamosa, doing this private screening last night. Before I let you go, I kind of want to ask a couple more things. First, got any movie plans to go see a movie this weekend or anything like that? I know Begonia's out. You got any, going to go see anything soon?
A lot I need to see, but headed back to Telluride to show the movie there.
Nice.
So, yeah, still for a while stuck watching my own dang movie over and over again.
Yeah, what is this, the 300th, 400th time you've seen it?
It doesn't usually get better, but
yeah.
Always good to see, you know, what people respond to differently.
And my final question for you, what's in your future? You got anything planned that you can share with us at all? Anything that you're working on that you'd like to share?
Well, I produced a film along with my partner, Jesse Hope, and our whole same crew, largely, that my friend Ramsey directed, who was an editor on this movie, that is partially shot around Crestone.
Oh, nice.
Actually, as well as many other states and places. So working on finishing that up, and then hope to do another movie. I mean, I'll do them as long as they let me. So I don't know, but also every movie is your last one.
Right.
And if that's how it is, that's how it is. But I got some more in me if they'll let me do them.
Well, I sure would love to see your name again on some credits. I had a hell of a time last night and being in the theater with all those people, but getting to sit down and talk with a writer director, it's really kind of a privilege. So I really thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh man, pleasure is all mine.
Right on. Thank you very much, man. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to The Valley Pod. I'm Owen Woods, producer and editor of this episode. Hope you enjoyed our conversation with Max Walker Silverman. I sure did. It's a good conversation to talk film with a filmmaker and writer and director of a pretty interesting movie. I hope that you all get a chance to go see this film. It was shot in the San Luis Valley. It was produced in the San Luis Valley. A lot of locals are in it. A lot of local faces. I hope you get to enjoy it just as many of us did last Monday night. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. See you next time.
It's been a tough year for many folks in Monta Vista. As the holidays approach, a lot of us are feeling tired or anxious, but good things are still happening all around us. This year alone, the Lohr Foundation has partnered with your friends and neighbors to bring more than 75 community-driven projects to life, making things a little brighter here at home. Lohr funds ideas designed and led by Monta Vista locals of all ages, no nonprofit experience required. Whether it's helping neighbors save time or money, supporting families, or creating something that brings people together, your ideas can make a real impact. All it takes to get started is a simple conversation. And once your idea is approved, most projects receive funding within 30 days. So let's close out the year stronger together. Visit lohrfoundation.org or email Yvette at lohrfoundation.org to learn more.